today
on a very special episode of the Enneagram Journey.
You opening presents?
No, I shouldn't even open these. I mean, Joey, I am out of control. Joey, you have to do me a favor. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, please do not let me open another present, okay?
Okay.
Give me one more.
Okay.
Actually, it's Pam.
I'm sorry. Well, Pan.
No, my name is Pam.
Are you saying Pan or Pam?
I'm saying Pam. Yeah, I'm sorry. Who is this gentleman sitting behind you?
Hello, Ms. Lady. I'm Dale. I'm Brennan's stepbrother, and I think I might be able to help with the Pan-Pam dilemma.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Pam.
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 With an
There's
M.
There's a D on the end.
There's no D. It's Pam.
It's like calm.
Here, it's P.
P-A-N-M.
M.
Two M. That was the confusion.
No, there's just one M. I think we've had enough.
Shut up for one
small day trying to get you, but they keep sending me different delivery people.
Trying to get me? Why?
Because I'm your daddy, that's why.
What'd you just say?
I said I'm your daddy. I'm Reese Bobby.
Me and your mama did it in a Rustler Steakhouse bathroom when I was 17. And then you showed up.
Son, did this go good?
No!
Seems to me like it went pretty good.
You're not my dad!
You got a little heated, but...
Stop talking to me!
Hey, is that a Huffy? That's a nice-looking bike, boy.
I had a Huffy when I was younger. My older sisters took it and my friends and played chicken. Then they both chickened out the same time and swerved the same direction and killed my bike. But that's a story for you and for my therapist and for a different day. Today, we get to hear from Enneagram 8, Matt Lesser, who's the third of our series with three members of the 2024 Enneagram cohort led by Suzanne Stabile. My name's Joel, and I, of course, will be along for the ride. As you'll find out, Matt knows a good tool when he sees one, and his Enneagram journey started in 2016. He's going to share some impactful stories from his childhood all the way up to present day. You can learn more about Matt by visiting uniquelynormal.com or clicking on the link in the show notes, including where to find his latest book, Unengaged, Building Flourishing Organizations. While you're surfing around on the old interweb, go ahead and stop on over at lifeinthetrinityministry.com to see what's going on and what's coming up. Here are the bullet points. March 31st is the final day to get that super early bird special for the 2024 Enneagram Boot Camp, August 1st through 3rd, Stress, Loss, and Relationships. But if you miss that deadline, you'll still have plenty of time for the early bird registration. April 1 is the final day to apply for the 2024 Leading Change cohort with Dr. Andy Stoker at the Micah Center. The 2024 Calvin Festival of Faith and Writing in Grand Rapids, Michigan is April 10th through the 13th, and Suzanne will be leading the Cadillac of Enneagram workshops, Know Your Number, on the 10th. If you can't make that, how about you sign up for the Know Your Number in Dallas, April 27th at Lake Highlands UMC. Heck, make a weekend of it, enjoying Suzanne, Joe, and Tony Jones with musical guest Ronnie Faust as they journey into wild places Friday night, April 26th at the Micah Center. We also have new audio downloads available and great material dropping soon on the table, LTM's online subscription service. So go ahead and add lifeinthetrinityministry.com to your bookmarks page. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast, of LTM and Joe and Suzanne's ministry. LTM is a place for all to come and do solitary work that cannot be done alone. And now, Suzanne and Matt.
Ooh, what a lovely room you're in. Love those books. Love the wood. Love the bricks. Love it all.
Thank you. This is my office at home, so I love this. So it's a great place to study and think.
And be, right?
And be, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is my office at home.
Nice. I love it.
Yeah. The books don't fit in here, so they're in a room all their own.
Yeah. Well, you're seeing one bookshelf, and I have, last time I counted, I have 11 just like this in this room full of books.
Yeah, good.
So
well,
I
then,
love books.
Yeah, I love books too. And Amazon loves me.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's I think they know me by first name now, that my delivery driver. That's not a good thing.
Oh. For a while, Joe was teasing me by saying, are you in the Amazon guy just friends? Like, what's happening?
Wow.
I said, yes, nice. we are becoming friends because that's my nature.
I love it.
Okay. Welcome. Good to have a chance to visit with you. I'm fascinated by the diversity that seems to make up your life. And I think we'll be really privileged to have you in this Enneagram cohort.
Thank you.
I think you have a lot to offer, and I think you will receive probably more than you imagine. That seems to be the result, but I shouldn't put that on you. I'll let you have the experience. And then I don't know if Joel, we probably should talk again about what we're doing in terms of first and last and maybe middle and all those things.
Okay. That'd be great. Well, just want to say that I'm honored and I'm really looking forward to being a part of this journey this year. So thank you.
Sure.
And for you, the listener, so this is our second recording. The first one was with Alex, and now we've got Matt here, who is also an Enneagram 8. So I'm excited to hear the differences over, well, one right now, and then over the year, just the different experiences that the two of you have. Then we've got a third recording later today with Darnell, who is an Enneagram 1 from the Northeast. The idea is like, hey, let's kind of do a check-in and meet y'all, meet a few people that are in the Enneagram cohort. And then the original plan was that, and then after all four quarters at the end of the year, check in again. But then I was thinking, that's such a long time, and I bet these conversations are going to be so good. So we are teasing the possibility of maybe midway through in that summer after the second gathering, doing a check-in as well. You know, it is the Enneagram journey, and I love, we've mentioned it several times over the years, the name of the podcast is the Enneagram journey because part of it's Enneagram, and then the other part's journey, and it doesn't, not everything has to be Enneagram, and some things are, and not everything has to be the journey, and a lot of things are. So I think that between the three of y'all, hopefully three episodes a piece, that we're going to get a whole lot of journey and some Enneagram in there.
Life is a journey, so I'm with you.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's an astonishing journey, actually. So many surprises. So many surprises.
Oh, that is so true.
Okay, well, one of the first things that I'm most excited to talk about, and maybe I shouldn't be, and I do have an anticipated, hoped-for response, which is a manipulative thing for me to say that I need you to ignore. It would be dishonest to not say it, and yet you shared with us that you're trained and certified in nearly 20 different instruments for assessing personality and the way people see the world. Mm-hmm. Why 20? What's the best one? And why?
So why 20? Because it's a nice round number. No, I'm kidding. I don't know why 20. I've come across different instruments over the years. And my first exposure to an assessment was actually the DISC assessment. And it was so profound in helping me understand me and me understand my wife and my wife understand me and understand her that literally we had so many ahas. I'm a high D. She's a high S. Can't get more opposite than that. On Enneagram, I'm an 8. She's a 9. And we just see the world through different lenses. And when we were first married, I would say things that were so stupid, like, why can't you just think like me? Because in my mind, that was the solution. You know, whenever we had a conflict or disagreement, it's like, well, it can't be my fault. I'm not the one who's in error here. And I was so immature and young. And I've learned a lot since then. A lot of life has happened. And but Suzanne, when I began to realize there are instruments out there that help you understand you first and others second, I just became, I guess you can call it, near obsessed. And I wanted to learn more and more and more. And so so whenever I came across an instrument, if there was a possibility of getting trained and certified in it, I wanted to be all in. And so I just kept diving into different instruments, whether they were personality based or leadership based or team based or conflict, doesn't matter. I just wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. And then finally I was exposed to Enneagram probably 6-7 years ago. I think it was 2016 or 17, so maybe 7-8 years ago. And again, it was one of those, first of all, I was overwhelmed. I sat through a training completely overwhelmed by it, and I didn't really understand it. And then I bought your book, the Road Back to You. And I bought one for me and my wife. We read it together and I started with 8 and then 9. And we had such rich conversation. I mean, many times there were tears, just because there were the way that things were worded and phrased and helping explain each of us to each other, was profound. And it gave us additional insight. And at that point, we got married in 96. So at that point, we've been married for 22 years. But still, we were still learning about one another, still hungry to learn about one another. And so I guess that's probably the answer to the word why. As far as the best, I know the answer that you want me to give.
The truth. The truth is what I want.
I don't know that. Honestly, I can't necessarily say that. I can't give a rank order. Sure. I have been asked that before. Mm-hmm. I really can't, because each one has a different lens. And so I'm a big believer that you learn about yourself and others through different lenses, and okay, assessments are one lens. Your story is another lens. And in fact, I think that's a more important lens. And so I can't tell you that one's more important than another, because they each give you a different perspective that helps expand the story and give mm-hmm. you a more holistic view of you and the other person. And so Enneagram is in my top three, so I will tell you that. So Enneagram Live Style is one of my go-tos when I'm working with teams, especially because it's a nice cross-section of about 9 different assessments. I still love DISC. I love Myers-Briggs if it's used in the way it's intended to be used. So those are probably my top four. Mm-hmm. And then I love to get more specific, especially if you talk about things like if I'm working with somebody or a couple or a team that is having difficulty managing conflict, for example, then we'll get very specific in assessments like that. So
sure.
You asked me 3 questions. I think I only answered 2.
Well, you did a great job with the 2. And I have another question about your top 4. And okay, this is an honest question. I'm not like I don't have a dog in the hunt here, even though I'm an Enneagram person. Do the other 3 that are in your top four have ongoing ways for you to work and learn and grow? Like, do they go with you like the Enneagram does? Can you go deeper and deeper and deeper? Are they identifiers and then other assessments complement them in going deeper?
Great question. The Enneagram is the first assessment that I have, if I can even call it that. I don't even like referring to the Enneagram as assessment because it's a journey, it's a story. The Enneagram is the first instrument, if I can use that as a better term, mm-hmm. that I have come across that is more of a living, breathing type of it's a journey. It really is. Every time I read a book on it, or I sit through a training on it, or I listen to a podcast or whatever it is, I learn something new that I didn't have before. And mm-hmm. I can't necessarily say that I have those aha experiences with other assessments. And so, mm-hmm. So to your point, I think Enneagram is a journey that you just keep going deeper and deeper, and you learn more and more, and you just get a bigger and expanded story.
Well, one of the reasons I asked you the question is I was testing myself, because I teach that the Enneagram, and I'm not trained in the areas that you are, certainly not in as many. But one of the things I teach is that the Enneagram is non-static, and that most assessments are not continuing to add to your experience. They're non-static experiences that help you identify a part of yourself. And I'm all for all of it. I wanted to make sure I was teaching the right thing. So I'm going to tell people an expert told me.
What you just said, I can agree with.
Great.
I'm going to try not to reference a million times our conversation with Alex, but yep, with y'all both being 8s and then how we came out of the shoot in this conversation, Alex talked a lot that with spiritual practices, that he's collected a lot of different spiritual practices. Is that an innate thing? I don't know.
If you want to rephrase it and say, is it easy to get obsessed over something? The answer is yes. And so I think that, to answer your question, I think that that is something that I have to be careful with. Obviously the eights struggle with lust, and I don't mean sexual lust necessarily, although it can be one. I have to really monitor myself that I don't get obsessed with something and go all in, especially too quickly, because one of my philosophies is, my family gives me a hard time about this, is that if one is good, 10 is better, and 100 is ideal. And buy in bulk. And so, when I go to Sam's Club now, or one of the Costco or any of those, I have to have somebody go with me almost as my sponsor, because I love those places. And I say that in jest, but it's actually true. It is something that I have had to learn to really grow in myself over the years. But even in spiritual practices, once something works for you, or especially for me anyway, I don't want to just stop there. It's like, okay, well, if meditation works, then I want to go to times of solitude and silence. If that works, I want to try memorization. If that works, I want to try this. If that works, I'm going to try that. And so there's this unending thirst for more. And that's something that I have struggled with most of my life. And I've realized over those last few years, God's had me on this really interesting journey. And I describe it as the most painful journey I've ever been on in my life, but it's also been the sweetest and the most joyful, because God has revealed some of this darkness in me. And when I default to my natural state of more and more and more, it's actually less. And that's what it leads to. It's learning to live in moderation and learning to accept that sometimes good is okay. Sometimes I don't have to have the best.
It sounds to me like you have a seven wing, a big one. Those two numbers both pretty much require research before trust. Mm. So if you combine the two, then I have to check this from a lot of angles. Because I'm feeling vulnerable and that doesn't feel great. And so I'll see how this holds up if I check it with this and this and this and this and this. Mm-hmm. Does that ring true for you?
It does. It does. Yeah. Yeah. It's trust but verify.
A fan of the show Friends when it was on. I just, in my head, you talked about, your wife's a nine and you as an eight and doing this, and there's a, the idea kind of reminds me of a scene when Monica wants to open one of the wedding presents, but Chandler's not there. And she's like, I'm just going to open one. And so she opens one, and then she opens another one. She's like, that one is really small. And this one probably goes with it. It looks like it's a set. So then she opens the next one. And then she says to Joey, she's like, listen, you cannot let me open anything else. And he's like, okay, you got it. You can't open anything else. She goes, except for maybe this one over there. And he goes, okay, yeah, open that one. And that just kind of sounds like you as an eight, doing these things. And I can mm-hmm. see your wife being like, okay, I'll hold you accountable a little bit, but also, okay, if you want to.
Yeah. And the longer that she and I have been married, and as she has grown in her own, she has gotten much more, she's been much more willing to confront and step up and say, hey, just stop. And we're early when we were married, that would never happen. So I've seen a lot of growth in her as well.
Mm. Let's do a little journey through the pieces of your life that you've shared with us in the information for the podcast. And I'd like to start with the fact that when you were 15, you experienced a life-threatening illness. And so you spent the better part of a year in the hospital for treatment. Generally, if something is that intense, people can remember themselves in that space. Mm-hmm. Can you?
Absolutely.
Were you in five behavior, anagram-wise, in that time?
I would say it was this first half, I was in more ape behavior because I was angry. And I had just come out of a summer of preparing. Up till that point in my life, I was overweight. I was not athletic. I was the last person picked on the and for PE, all the things you'd imagine for an overweight kid, made fun of. And I had decided in my eighth grade year, so I was going into my ninth grade year when I got sick. My eighth grade year, I found soccer, and I was actually pretty good at it. And I was the goalie, but it motivated me to get in shape. And so I was in primo shape going into my ninth grade year, and I got sick. I was ticked. I was just ticked off. And I stayed in that mode for about the first half of my illness until literally it was almost, I describe it as an epiphany type moment. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was alone in my hotel, in my hospital room.
If only.
I was climbing back into bed because the treatments made me very ill. So I was vomiting. And I just happened to glance at the clock in the wall. I'm not sure why. I just did. It was about 2:15 in the morning. And I had this thought. I believe it was from God. And literally, it was something like this. It was like, you know, here I am, ticked off, irritated, miserable, mad at the world because of this thing that I can't control. And I'm mad at God for this, but yet he's the one person that can actually heal me. And so I literally said, God, I'm done being angry. I'm done being mad at you because you can actually heal me if you choose to do so. And so that's it. I surrender. I give up and I give my life to you. And Suzanne, I have been asked over the years many times, were you healed that night? And the answer is no. I still had the illness for another 6 months before it went away. But my heart was healed.
So the answer is yes.
Exactly. My perspective was healed. And from that point forward, I think I probably was more in, I probably was more in my seven wing because, you know, I would play poker with my nurses and, you know, we'd bet nickels and we had, I actually had fun. And I remember my experience in two very distinct journeys, the first half and the second half.
That's very valuable for eights to hear, for everybody to hear who is in a relationship with eights, because after the anger, there is space. And people tend to not make room for eights to express anger as they feel it. They've been told their whole lives to not be so angry and don't be so aggressive, don't be too any of these things. And there's an end to eight anger if you allow it to play out, if there's space for that. And it usually ends up either in the number you go to in stress, which would be five, and it would be you pulling back some and not being so aggressive. And a wing is helpful in those times and in those moments. I am so glad that in LTM, we have a commitment to making space for wherever people find themselves on the journey. Because one of the best things that occurs, and I'll be interested in hearing you speak to that now and then at the end, having experienced what I know you will find, because it has repeated itself over and over and over. In reading what you shared with us, one of the things that you offered that I will have Joel talk to you in a minute, and I'll go get it out of the printer because I printed it because I wanted to have it at hand, and I ate cheese and crackers instead in between podcasts, but it's printed, so I'm going to go get it in a minute. And that is that I want to read the Philippians reading that you referenced. And I want to set the table for what is obvious in what you've shared with us, and that is that you are choosing to be vulnerable enough to grow spiritually in ways that include direction from other people. That's an astonishing thing for an eight to be able to say. I have an accountability partner of 25 years that I meet with at least two times a month. me too. I read the Divine Hours lots of times, three times a day. As a former Roman Catholic priest, that's Joe's life. The Divine Hours were part of every day of his life for 26 years. A personal board of directors that I meet with quarterly. And this practice that you have in reading the Lord's Prayer, one of the things I'm anxious to share with you, if you don't already know it, do you know the work of K.J. Ramsey?
I'm familiar but of the name, but I'm not familiar with the work.
Well, she's done a beautiful, beautiful thing and written a book about her relationship with the Lord's Prayer. And I think you would really love that.
Okay.
But aside from that, what I found listed is I'm doing all of these things, some quarterly, some weekly, some monthly, some daily, but I'm doing these things to make sure that I stay headed in the right direction. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would look at this list. A lot of people in the cohort with you would hear this and think, I can't do that. And that's the truth. They can't, because they don't have eight energy. Mm. And numbers with less energy can't accommodate that much input and manage to feel safe in all of that. And so I automatically then, you see, have something to work with in the room when we're talking about energy levels and how different people manage their journey, because there's a tendency, of course, to compare. Oh, well, I don't do that many things, so I shouldn't be here, or I'm not going to contribute to the conversation because I haven't done that. Well, that all depends on your Enneagram number, how much of that you can accommodate. So Joel, if you'll speak to that and whatever you want to talk about, just till I can go to the printer and I'll be right back.
If you want, I've got the scripture pulled up.
Yeah, I have to look though. Okay. I'm so visual. I'll be right back.
All right. Well, she already took out the headphones because I'm going to hold off for her to get back because I have a question about anger compared to fear and shame and all things. So we'll just hold for a moment.
Okay. That's fine. No problem.
All right. So while she's getting that together, the question I have for the two of you, building off of, you know, just said the phrase, you know, how different people manage their journey, that you, Matt, just instinctually managed that trauma and that point in your life with anger. Like that was how you were managing it. And we've got between the three of us, all three triads covered, between 8, 9, 1 with anger, 2, 3, 4 with you, Mom, and shame, and me with fear. And I just don't, if I'm putting myself in your shoes, I'm probably going to react with more fear stuff and manage it with fear. I don't see myself being angry in that. And then I'm curious, Mom, if yours would be shame or has been shame when you've been in stuff like that.
Yeah, it's shame for me for sure. Shame about not being able to handle it better. Shame about being needy. Shame about, in your story, I was overweight and I shouldn't have been, and that probably contributed to this. And I was finally getting it together, but now nobody's ever going to pick me, and that makes me feel shame. All of the things. But to get angry, I would have to have therapy, because that's not my default emotion. And there are things there to be angry about, but I would have to have somebody walk me there. And I think anytime we experience trauma, we allow our default emotion to take over because we don't know the language or the default emotion, or that there are other options, because it's the lens.
Yeah.
So that's a super question, Joel. What would you do?
I don't know. I think, I don't know if this is a 7 thing or if it's a me thing. I kind of accept things as they come. It's like, well, this is what it is. And I suppose part of that has to do with orientation at the time. And we've talked about that recently with, I forget who it was. We had a great conversation about looking back on things. And so in that, I do think that the motivations that I would have, the things that I would do, would come from some space of fear, whether it's, you know, joking around and playing around with the nurses, or my relationship with, you know, at this stage of my life. You know, this, you said you were going to be a freshman in high school. So probably with my relationships with my friends and family. But it'd be a lot harder, I think, for me to, for people to see, because it's seven energy and behavior with fear, covering up the fear. Does that make sense? So I don't know exactly what my behavior would be, but I know that it would be now at this point, looking back and with what I've learned, fear-based. And I think, and what I, the reason why I think it's an important question or important thing for us to stop and look at is just because for people that are maybe going through a little something and new to the Enneagram and still trying to figure out where they fit in it and where it fits in their life, that I think regardless of stress and security movement or anything, that that core emotion is going to be there. So for you, Mom, even if in the moments of going, you know, to some eight space during that or four space during that, shame is still going to be the thing that's driving it. And same with you, Matt, that anger, no matter if you're going to five or two, and same with me, even in one space, when I, you know, the one space, the anger that I have when I'm in low one isn't, it's still masking up the fear. It's not the primary emotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think in fear, Joel, you would be, it's all good. And I think Matt, in your aggression as an eight, you would be, I'm going to beat this. Mm-hmm. And I would be in the present moment thinking I'm going to be here forever. Like there's no way out of this for me. So you two have it better than me, clearly. All right.
I don't know about that.
I did not like your outlook from it. I can tell you that much.
Yeah, you don't want to be me.
Oh, man.
I was like, man, I don't know. Am I going to get a make-a-wish thing here? Like, will I get to meet somebody? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And you would be either extreme as a seven. You would be either totally down and out and non-relational, or you would be making jokes and, you know, juggling things around. And Matt would be fighting. I'm fighting the reality first, and now I'm fighting the disease, but not fighting alone. And that's why I want to get to the Philippians reading. So you listed Philippians 4:6-7. I'm going to read the NIV version. Okay. Do not be anxious about anything. There you have it. But in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. What a great scripture.
Amen.
And there are a lot of things that you've shared with us that follow the scripture. But before we get to that, would you be willing to talk about the second hurdle and the time when you went through clinical and suicidal depression in your mid-20s when your father left and left you with a failing business?
Absolutely. So when I, just a little bit of context and I'll get into it. When I went to college to study business. I grew up in a family business. I didn't know that anything existed but business, really. But I really didn't have a desire to work for my dad. He and I just didn't see eye to eye on, well, everything. But after college, I needed a job. And so I went to work for him. And a year and a half into it, I'd had it, couldn't take it anymore. So I went in to resign, said, Dad, this isn't working out. One of us needs to leave. Probably not going to be you because you own the stock. So I'm leaving. Didn't know what I was going to do. I had some aspiration to go to seminary, become a pastor, but I didn't know. And my wife and I had just been married at that point a few months. And he literally said, sit down. And so I did. And he said, actually, I'm leaving. And he meant it. And he left my mom, divorced my mom. They'd been married for 29 years. My middle brother went with him and he moved 1,200 miles away. The way out the door, he signed the business over to me. Here I am, mid-20s, freshly minted. You know, I had two bachelor's degrees, both in business. And I was cocky and arrogant are probably the two words I'd have to use. And I thought I could do anything. And so I'm like, yes, here we go. I got my chance. Let's do this thing. And over the course of the first 90 days of me at the helm, you know, I literally, it's like, you know, I can't tell you how excited I was to sign my first document, you know, president of a company, you know, 25. I thought that was the cat's meow. I thought that was great. And, but yet over the course of the next 90 days, I ran into three major hurdles that I could not climb over. The first was trade debt. I quickly realized when I had suppliers that were cutting me off because of unpaid bills that I knew nothing about, it all added up to over $1 million on a company that in a good year would make 250 to 300. In other words, I couldn't repay it. Second was we were in the oil business and we had C-stores, and a couple of those locations had underground storage tanks that were leaking fuel onto neighboring properties. EPA gets pretty grumpy about that. And so that was hurdle number two. Number three, because I had no money to clean them up. Number three, withholding tax wasn't paid for a year. And the IRS will prosecute you criminally, and they don't really care who, if you've been sitting in that chair for a day, a year, or 10 years, if your name's on the bottom line now, you're going to jail. All that hit me at once. I was overwhelmed. I didn't know what to do. I felt all alone. I felt like I had no place to go. So I first began experiencing acute anxiety. I didn't have any of the terminology. Then that led to panic attacks. Panic attacks so badly that literally every time the phone would ring, I'd run to the bathroom and throw up. Then that led to not getting out of bed. And so this started in July. By Thanksgiving of that year, I was not getting out of bed. By January of the following year, I was suicidal. I didn't see any way out. The only way I describe it is I felt like I was in this deep black hole with no light, no hope, no helpless. I described the walls as being like glass, so I couldn't climb out, and I was stuck. And, you know, I did the best I could to try to cover up what was going on, not cover up, but, you know, protect my wife from this all. She knew things were bad. She didn't know how bad they were. And so literally I got up one day in mid-January. This would have been 1998 at this point, mid-January of 98, and had decided to take my life. Went to my office, been the first time I was in my office at that point for about 2 months, and maybe three, actually, no, two, about 2 months. Pulled out three pieces of paper and was going to write three letters, one to my wife, one to my mom, who I had hired actually to work for me. She was trying to keep things together while I was sick. And then my little brother, who I felt responsible for. He stayed with my mom. And not one word ever got written. I had a fleeting thought that my I knew my parents had taken out a life insurance policy on me. I knew nothing about it. And so rather than calling the agent, who was a lifelong friend of my mom's, I drove three blocks to his office. He happened to be in. We spent 15 minutes together. I don't ever remember using the word suicide. I must have at least hinted at it or something. I don't know. I left his office, came back to my office. My mom met me at the door and said, come on, let's go out for tea, which is what we would do sometimes. I said, okay. And she said, I'll drive, which was odd, but I said, okay, fine, you drive. As we were driving to tea, she turned a different direction. And I said, where are we going? And she said, to see a friend. I found out years later that when I left my life insurance agent's office, he picked up the phone and called my mom. And he said, her name was Jean. She passed away in 2012. She said, gee, he just said, Jean, I know things are a mess. None of that matters right now. I just saw your son. And if you don't do something today, he's not going to be with us tomorrow. She hung up the phone and called the only other person that she could think of that went through something very similar to what I was going through literally a decade prior. And it was a local businessman who was a firm believer in God and had come through this with flying colors. He was very wealthy. And so as we're pulling into his office, I said, oh, no, I'm not going in there, because all I knew about this guy, I grew up with his kids. I knew who he was. I just said, hey, I'm not going in there. This guy was tall, deep voice, very wealthy, powerful, and he scared me. And I just said, I'm not going in. And so my mom said, that's okay. He said he would actually come sit in the car with us then. He's a one on the Enneagram, by the way. And so we went in and we spent half a day in his office. And at the end of that time, he never said, I'll fix it. He just said, I will walk with you through this.
There you go.
He did. And he got me help. So I was, I got clinical help for a while. I was severely, but I was heavily medicated for a while. And then I got into counseling after that with he was a pastor, and he decided that God wanted him to be a counselor. And my wife and I went to him for 6 years, and that completely reoriented not only our lives individually, but as a married couple. And Suzanne, you know, I could go on and on and on. I'll stop there, but I'm going to give you two major lessons that I learned from that. One was I'm not in control. Mm-hmm. And two is I need God and I need people. And, mm-hmm. and that's the only way I can make it in life. And up to that point, I would have said that I don't really, you know, I would have viewed God as, okay, God, I had a relationship with God. It was a distant one. You know, I always viewed God as being this very judgmental, harsh, because I viewed him through the lens of my dad. And so it's like, God, I'm going to put you on the shelf. If I need you, I'll let you know. And so God became very real to me during that time. But the other thing was, is that my need for people, I cannot do this on this own. You know, I'm naturally wired to be a maverick. I'm naturally wired to do it on my own and just jump in. And I realized if I continue to do this, I'm going to screw up my life and it's not going to work. At least it's not going to work in a way that I think God wants it to work. Right. And I still struggle with that to this day. My natural bend is to still do it alone, but I realize that's not who I am. It's not who I want to be. It is who I am. It's not who I want to be.
Yep.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's a really great story that has to do with the difference in change and transformation. And the definitions that I use are that change occurs when you take on something new, but transformation occurs when something old falls away, usually beyond your control. And you had a transformative opportunity as a very aggressive number on the Enneagram, and you chose to be vulnerable to that. And that's a choice. And it doesn't matter what the circumstances are. People don't have to, people who are listening, don't have to have that kind of trauma to recognize that it's a transformative opportunity if something old has fallen away beyond your control. And you mentioned control, all the things. And so it rings very true to me in relationship to the things that I know. The next thing I want you to share with our listeners about that is exciting to me is that you have some language you use that starts conversations rather than perhaps pausing them or ending them. And the first is Jehovah Jireh became real to me in those times. I had to go to Joe and say, okay, I don't know what this is. And without taking a breath, he said, well, that's just God provides.
Amen.
And I said, oh, okay. So let's talk about for a minute how an eight, a white male eight, gets from, I don't need any help providing. That's what I do. I provide for me. I provide for my people. I provide for other people because here at the head of the helm, is that the word?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I don't like it, but Joel can fix it. At the head, okay. take all this out, Joel, and Joel, I'm just going to start back here.
Joel can change
here.
The words.
If you had my voice, like if we can get an AI voice, you can have me say whatever you want me to.
Nice.
Which, by the way, I would veto. I mean, I just thought that over for 30 seconds and thought, yeah, we're not doing that.
No.
Here's what I want to say. Jehovah Jireh, God provides, is you saying, I'm aware that I cannot provide by myself for everything. I think the entire faith journey, in my experience, regardless of faith belief or denomination, is understanding that there's something bigger than you are. Mm-hmm. And it must feel so good for you, having been left with so much responsibility following a severe illness with a little brother and your mom and a wife and feeling responsible for all of it. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to live into, but I don't have to do it by myself.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's a, the first word that comes to mind is, it's freeing, knowing that it doesn't all fall on me, that, you know, I can do what I can do. I can do my part, but that's all I can do. And it's accepting that, guess what, Matt, you have limitations and it's okay. Mm-hmm. And that's hard for me to, it's even hard for me to say that to this day because everything in me wants to fight against that. But it's true. And I need to accept truth. I need to speak truth to me. And I think that's probably the second thing is, what is true? What isn't true is that I do this all on my own. You know, I, for example, one of the terms that I just really dislike in our society is the self-made person. Mm-hmm. I don't believe anybody is self-made. Everybody is helped at some point. You are helped. Even Jeff Bezos was helped at some point. And it's just acknowledging that, you know, why do we have to put on a pedestal people that are so-called self-made when they were helped? Because I think it puts this pressure, you know, it was drilled into me all growing up. And then it was exacerbated in college where, you know, you're told you have to do this on your own. You have to push through, you have to do this. And to even stop and say, I can't. It's not that I won't. I can't. Mm-hmm. I cannot take another step on my own power, on my own strength. I need help. And I think just accepting that reality, coming to that, which I didn't come to on my own. That was a God thing in my life. Okay. And it continues to make that real today, to this day. I mean, it's, you know, 3 years ago, I went on my own, completely on faith, and started a business on my own. And Philippians 4:6-7 has become real to me all over again because it's not on my power. It's God. And literally, I almost every day I say, God, I'm doing my part, but this isn't going to work unless you do your part.
Right.
And so, right. So I think that's, I does that answer your question? I mean, absolutely. I tried to give you some, okay.
Absolutely. It does. And it's so helpful because people who make up the family and friend circle of Enneagram eights, particularly male Enneagram eights, tend to go to them with everything. Our youngest son, BJ, and Joe and I were having lunch after he was an adult and had moved back here, kind of talking about part of his journey. And he's a 4 on the Enneagram, but he said, you know, y'all have helped me so much and I'm so thankful. And I've been able to come to you with things that I was really worried about and kind of afraid of. And you were there, but I got to tell you, there are times when I skip you and just go straight to Joey. That's the 8 in our family, our oldest daughter. To which I responded, we all do. And then I journaled about that for several days after that and recognized that we intuitively go to where we think the strength is. And that's a big burden for eights to carry. And in your shoes at that time in your life, it was a really big burden. Mm-hmm. I've not talked to very many people who have the faith life that you have, who have not experienced a dark night of the soul. And you're no exception. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Glad to. There was a period of time when I was, this was actually more recent. So you mean the more recent one? Is that what you mean, Suzanne?
Yes.
Okay. So after the business grew and it really took off, and so I sold it in 2007 to a competitor that took good care of our people. I then went into private equity and I spent 12 years in the world of private equity. And I actually went to work for the man who walked beside me all those years. He took me under his wing, mentored me. We had a great relationship. And so he was getting ready to sell his business and start this private equity firm. So I joined him. Towards the end of my time there, I really got restless and I really devolved into mentally. Many reasons why that was happening, but I didn't have words for it. I just felt like God was saying it's time. And so I left really with no place to go. Wound up going to 2 different places for 1 year each. And the first one was a very bad experience. And I wound up hurting my reputation. I wound up getting let go. I have never failed at that on my own like that in my life, and nearly lost everything that I would say was dear to me. And I spent the better part of the next year and a half to 2 years really just diving into my soul and saying, what is going on with me? And, you know, hired a counselor. That's when I hired a spiritual director to really help me on this journey, because I knew it was spiritual. But I didn't know what. I didn't have words. I didn't have understanding. I just knew that I was in a really dark place. And so I then started going to these quarterly retreats that I've been going to now for almost, that I'm getting ready to wrap up actually in February. And the majority of that time is spent in silence and solitude. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, Suzanne, the depth, the dryness of my soul, the dryness of my spiritual life until I went to my first retreat. And when I had time, literally time and space for God and just God and me, something began to happen. And that's, and that something is that God began to reveal himself to me, reveal me to me in ways that I had never seen before. And began to realize real quickly, my whole identity, my entire career life, my professional identity, in many ways, my personal identity was wrapped up in my work, in what I did, in my doing. And God took me, has been taking me on a journey now for 2 years of resetting that and recentering my identity in him and in my being, and my being and my belonging to him. And out of that comes my doing. Mm-hmm. And I had completely, I had it reversed most of my life, and it stopped working. My life literally just stopped working. And again, I'm so grateful now looking back on it, because I don't know if I know I wouldn't be sitting here today without going through that experience. But man, it's been life altering. It really has been, it's been transformational in so many ways.
You know, that's very helpful. I'm so excited that we're, podcasting, because, it's not every day that most people hear a male eight say everything stopped working. Generally, that's unacceptable talk. And so I'm very thankful for the integrity of your word in all of that. And I'm excited to watch in what you shared and your timeline of the highlights of your opportunities for spiritual growth and awareness. Because that is followed in what you shared by Jehovah Shalom, which, of course, I didn't have to go ask Joe. I knew that that was the Lord is peace. So I felt great about that. I did have to go, though, for Jehovah Shema. And Joe explained to me that that means the Lord is there. The Lord is there in the temple. The Lord is there, meaning I have access to the Lord.
Yeah.
And I think in our culture, the typical way of being in a relationship with our understanding of who God is might be to come and go when you need something, but it's not often that people have enough input and language from outside of themselves to be able to mark their spiritual journey the way that you can mark yours.
Mm.
And I hope that you're excited to see what's next, because I am.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to see what's next on your journey. And it is my best hope that, and belief, that being part of the cohort will be a part of that.
I am excited too.
I'm so sure that you have so much to offer, and that there will be people there who are absolutely not as faith-filled as you are. It will be interesting to watch them trust your journey and to watch an eight have compassion for theirs. And I have no doubt that I'll experience both of those too. Joel and I really get the sweet spot. You know, we just get to experience all the things that y'all do with each other. I just provide fodder for you to work with.
I love it.
Joel, do you have anything else?
Yeah. You know, as part of this series, can you talk a little bit about like what your, not expectations are, but if you have a goal, if you have an idea of like, okay, what are you hoping may be different in you in 11 months versus today?
Great question, Joel. I'm hoping for even greater awareness, and I'm hoping for a greater understanding of the who. You know, God has created us each with a unique wiring and unique set of experiences that have contributed to that. But I want to more fully understand and more fully embrace who I am. And, you know, and understand that my identity flows from my relationship with God, but he's created us in a very unique way, each of us. And so, I mean, there's no two people alike, even identical twins aren't fully alike. And so, so I'm hoping to continue to learn on this journey of self-discovery, and then be able to, and I love what Suzanne said about compassion, which is a word that, you know, I used to think that was a cuss word. Because it's this last 2 years in particular, Joel, have just been a journey that I would have never expected, and I'm so grateful for. And so I'm viewing this as an extension of that journey to see what God has in store.
It's amazing the number of people we come across that are partnered up in one way or another as an 8 and a 9. Can you talk just real quick a little bit about kind of the pros and cons of that?
Sure. It's a, my wife, the more that I have embraced the 9 of my wife, it has made me better. It's made me more effective. And it's made me a better version of me in adding her to me. And hopefully she would say the same about me. In some ways, I mean, there's some ways that she wouldn't want to add to her. But the two of us together, I think today really is 1 + 1 = 2. When we were first married, I would say it was more 1 - 1 because we didn't understand each other. We didn't appreciate our differences. We didn't appreciate what each of us brought to each other. And so there was really none of that iron sharpening iron, Proverbs 27:17. As we have grown in our relationship, especially over these last 4 years in particular, we have become more aware of what each other brings to the other person. And rather than pushing against it, we embrace it. Now, we don't do it perfectly. I don't think any married couple does. We have our moments just like any other married couple does. But I think at our heart, and our heart's desire is to continue to learn about one another and embrace those differences. So the cons are, is that, you know, in our weak moments, you know, for me, I'm most vulnerable, to displaying typical bad 8 behavior when I'm sick, when I'm overtired, or I'm stressed out. And so when I'm in one of those 3 modes, then the ugly tends to come out. And those are the times that, you know, shortly after I'm finding myself apologizing and repenting because I screwed up. And what that does though, is it makes her feel unsafe. And then she recoils from me, pulls back, and then it takes time then for her to step back in and say, okay, I have to learn to retrust you again because you hurt me. Is that helpful?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Very, very helpful. Well, I do have one thing I'd like to ask. Yes. How's your little brother?
He is, he's good, actually.
Good.
He's not had any contact with my dad, neither have I. And my dad's still living. But my brother is married. He has 2 kids of his own now. And he's doing well professionally. So I think he's doing very well.
Good.
My middle brother struggles.
It's just really hard when parents leave. When a parent just leaves, it's really hard to reconcile.
You got your brain scrambling with all the triangles and all the different lines.
Yes.
And is it just,
I'm learning a lot about family systems. I'm, you know, the Enneagram and Family Systems cohort is Andy is a family system scholar, and I'm an Enneagram scholar, but those two scholarlinesses are very different. And I'm continuing to learn so much from him. And if you've not ever done any family systems work, I would encourage it.
Okay. You're the third person now that's told me that in the last year.
Yeah. Well, that's God trying to get your attention, so you better get on it.
I will.
I know that feeling.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's like, oh, no.
Well, interestingly enough, my dad and I actually did reconcile in 10 years after he left. And I'd say we came to, I guess, at least an understanding. And and then his past actually caught up with him, and he was prosecuted and went to jail.
Oh.
I did not testify at his sentencing, and that was kind of it. And then that was the last time we talked. And so that was 2009.
Life is very complicated, isn't it?
It is.
And I happen to live in the world where I believe that all people are good people. Mm-hmm. And some are just exposed to different opportunities than others. And it's just, life is hard. It is just hard.
Amen.
Well, thank you so much for your time with us and for being part of this process. I don't know if we'll decide to do a middle one in the summer, but I think we'll know by the end of the day. We've already decided.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to say I've decided, but I wasn't sure Joel had. And so I wanted to not just, start saying stuff that we hadn't agreed on.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I look forward to the next two, I guess.
Yeah.
Rachel?
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
The next two.
And great. Seeing you in a week and a half. I mean,
yeah.
And, well, also the cohort. So
the cohort.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking forward to that, too.
Yeah. I'll be very anxious to watch you experience what you have to offer and what you receive.
I am looking forward to it from both aspects. So thank you so much.
You bet. Blessings
on you.